Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie here with John, and the first time in what feels like forever with a big case. And I don't know, we're on a roll here of cases where I'm like, I can't believe we haven't talked about this yet.
Yeah, man. Feels the same way for me. Hope you're doing well over there. Weather update. It's hot, and
it's hot again.
It's like the kind of hot you can't get no relief. So glad to be indoors doing this case with you, my man.
Can't wait to be in Denver here in a couple weeks for Crime Con. Should be a little better out there, I think.
I would hope so. Been to Colorado once in my life and really excited to get back.
Yeah. If you're interested in going again, that's Crime Con. It's like Comic Con, but
it's like
for
a conference for crime.
Yeah. So you go and you get to hear from victims' families, investigators. You get to meet all your favorite podcasters. We're going to be there on Podcast Row. Really excited to be there. If you're interested in going, you can get 10% off your ticket with code CRIMECAST.
Yeah, I'm excited. I know some folks that are going, and I'm looking forward to seeing them there in Denver. So, yeah, really excited. Please come check it out.
Yep, should be a good time. John, we have any new Patreon supporters we need to thank?
Nobody new this week, but I do just want to remind you, if you haven't already checked out Patreon, for as little as $3 a month, you have access to all of our bonus episodes. You get a brand new bonus episode each and every month, and you get our regular content early and ad-free.
Yeah, it's a great deal, and looking forward to, it's almost the 1st of September. So
yeah, got a new one coming up soon. Then.
Yeah, but John, today's case is one of those that is a big part of U.S. history, and we've talked about the JFK assassination, the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination. I want to get to RFK being assassinated at some point. There are so many big crimes like this in U.S. history, but one that I feel like is not talked enough about, and maybe it's just not as controversial as far as who did it and who didn't, but that's the murder of Malcolm X. So why don't you get us rolling? Tell us who this guy is.
Yeah, man, if you're anything like me, I mean, I definitely checked out a lot in school. Like, I don't know, I think I was definitely the ADHD kid that was halfway paying attention, but I don't remember talking about Malcolm X a lot when I was a kid.
Well, let's be honest, based on where you and I are from, it probably wasn't a focal point of learning American history.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad, but it's true. So, yeah, let's dig into this. I'm excited to learn more. So Malcolm Little was born on May 19th, 1925 in Omaha, Nebraska.
That's 100 years ago, bro. That's wild.
That is 100 years ago. Also, side note, Omaha, Nebraska, you ever get a chance to go, do it. Love that city.
Okay.
Anyway, he was the fourth of seven children of Louise and Earl Little. Earl was a Baptist preacher. He was killed when Malcolm was only 6 years old. So officially, it was ruled as a streetcar accident, which is a trolley, would you say? Like, I don't know, but more like a mode of transit instead of just like a recreational thing.
Right. Yeah. It's not a, yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good way to put it.
Streetcar. So many people believe this was not an accident, though. They believe he was deliberately killed in a racist attack by a white supremacist. But after Earl was gone, the rest of the family was so poor that Louise had to cook dandelions from the street in order to feed her children. So literally picking what we would consider weeds and cooking those to feed her kids.
Wow.
The stress of life was too much for her. And in 1938, she ended up having a nervous breakdown and she was committed to the Kalamazoo State Hospital. Now the children were separated into different foster homes. Wild to me to think of the foster care system 100 years ago and what that would look like. But that's where Malcolm and his siblings would grow up.
Yeah, just going through foster care training, I know, at least in Kentucky, all kinds of reform in the 70s and 80s. So to think of what it was like even further back than that is wild. And this is also during the Great Depression. So America wasn't a great place to be.
Yeah. Sorry, going back to, I remember teaching foster parenting classes, and in America, we had animal rights before we had human rights as far as foster care goes. So interesting time for sure.
Malcolm attended West Junior High School in Lansing, Michigan, and then Mason High School in Mason, Michigan. He excelled in school, was super bright, and he expressed interest in becoming an attorney one day. When he told one of his teachers, who, spoiler alert, was white, the teacher said that that was so no realistic goal for, and he used the N-word. Again, this is the 30s, so it's not to, that makes it okay, but that's what was happening then. And of course, that impacts a kid, hearing that from somebody in a leadership position, a place of authority. It really pushed Malcolm to drop out of high school. Starting at age 14, Malcolm had a bunch of jobs around town. He lived with his sister up in Boston after a short time there, and then he moved back over to Michigan, but he ended up in the New York City Harlem neighborhood. In 1943, he started getting involved in criminal activity, started dealing drugs, gambling, robbing places, and working in sex work as far as working with female sex workers. Not that he was involved in that part of the work himself. While working at Jimmy's Chicken Shack in Harlem, he made friends with John Elroy Sanford, who told him how much he wanted to be a stand-up comedian. Years later, John Elroy Sanford grew up to be the comedian we know as Red Fox.
It's really interesting. 1943, Malcolm was summoned by the draft board for military service in World War II. That was a crazy time to be alive. Not that I remember it personally, but you've grown up in the Great Depression, and now you're a young adult and called for service in one of the deadliest wars of human history.
And in case this is confusing, this was the draft. This was the country telling you go to war or go to prison.
Yeah, this was not a volunteer thing. So he did not want to go, and he pretended to be mentally disturbed in order not to go. He would, when he was before the board, he would start rambling and declaring that I went down south and I organized those N-word soldiers. We would steal us some guns and kill us some crackers. So he was not really saying all this to, like, because that's how he felt, but he wanted to be viewed as mentally ill. And it worked. He was declared mentally disqualified for military service. So in 1945, Malcolm returned to Boston, where he and four accomplices would start getting into a little bit of trouble. They would have some burglary issues. They were targeting wealthy white families. So I think in their minds, it was almost a Robin Hood situation. Steal from the rich, you know, take care of ourselves. In 1946, 21-year-old Malcolm was arrested while picking up a stolen watch from a repair shop, and for that crime, he was sentenced to 8 to 10 years in prison, and he was transferred to several prisons during that 8 to 10-year span of time.
Yeah, and you and I cover a lot of murder cases where people end up serving so little time in prison, and I know that we have all kinds of incarceration issues in our country with prisons being overpopulated and putting people in prison for minor things, and I don't know, 8 to 10 years for picking up a stolen watch. Again, he had a record. Maybe this is compounded. I don't know. But there was a lot going on. It was during this time in prison, though, that he found the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, who was the leader of the Nation of Islam. This organization advocated black nationalism and racial separatism. So they were Muslim, but this was a specific group of them focused on black people specifically in America.
It's a little confusing because, like, Islam is based on Muhammad, but this is Elijah Muhammad, who is in charge of a very particular group of Muslim people who have assembled together.
And it was very common in this time. Muhammad Ali converted to the Nation of Islam.
His name was really Cassius Clay.
Yep. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was Lou Alcindor when he was in college before he joined the Nation of Islam. So it was a very common thing to do. And usually you did change your name, as Elijah Muhammad had done. Malcolm could not get enough of this philosophy. He read everything he could get his hands on. So he started going by the name. And again, lots of people changed their name, but he chose Malcolm X, claiming that the X symbolized the African name that was stolen from his family when they were brought over here as slaves. In 1948, Malcolm wrote a letter to the leader of the Nation of Islam, again, whose name is Elijah Muhammad. Muhammad wrote back telling Malcolm to renounce his past, bow in prayer to God, and promise to never engage in destructive behavior again. The two continued their correspondence while Malcolm was in prison. Malcolm also wrote to President Harry Truman, expressing his strong opposition to the Korean War and declared himself a communist. This caught the attention of the FBI. If you just use the word communists, communism, socialism during this time, it was known as the Red Scare, another big historical era in America that I don't think we talk enough about.
We joke often like, oh, you're going to be put on a list. Well, back then you were literally put on a list
and an actual your life list.
Was investigated.
Yeah, very thoroughly. And I mean, we talked about in the Martin Luther King episode, I think that's part of what happened to him was his speaking out against the Vietnam War. After Malcolm X was paroled in 1952, he went to visit Elijah Muhammad in Chicago. And by June of the next year, he was named the assistant minister of the Nation of Islam's Temple No. 1 in Detroit. So he joined the Nation of Islam while he was in prison and quickly rose in the ranks once he got out. It sparked the FBI to continue looking into him even more, and they upped their surveillance on Malcolm X as he continued to gain a following and gain more power.
In 1955, after one of his lectures, Malcolm met a young lady named Betty Sanders. So they would meet again at a dinner party, and soon she was going to all of his lectures. In 1956, she ended up joining the Nation, and she would change her name to Betty X. Because of their religion, they had some beliefs that would prohibit them from actually going on dates together just one-on-one, but they were allowed to socialize at events, and Malcolm would often invite Betty to his group, and then that's where they would be able to visit more. In January of 1958, Malcolm ended up proposing to Betty over the phone, and only 2 days later, they were married. So over the years, they would end up having six daughters. The last two were a set of twins who were born after Malcolm X died, and we're going to get more into that here in just a moment.
There was one big incident in 1957 that continued to raise the prominence of Malcolm X, and that's when Nation of Islam member Hinton Johnson was beaten by two members of the New York City Police Department. Hinton and two others had seen officers beating a black man with nightsticks, so they decided that they were going to intervene and get the man away from the officers. When they did that, one of the officers turned and beat Hinton so badly that he had brain contusions and subdural hemorrhaging. All four black men involved were arrested. Malcolm was told about the incident, so he and a small group of men went to the police station to see Hinton. They originally wouldn't let Malcolm in, but a group of protesters outside grew to 500, so they decided it would alleviate the tension to allow Malcolm to come in and talk. After he spoke with Hinton, Malcolm insisted on taking him to the hospital. His injuries were treated, and he was brought back to the police station, now with thousands of protesters outside. Malcolm did all he could to have the three men bailed out, but when he was done, he addressed the crowd outside. He simply gave a hand signal, and the crowd dispersed. At that point, the NYPD also began keeping Malcolm X under surveillance, recognizing the amount of power that this man had over this large group of citizens. They also assigned some undercover officers to infiltrate the Nation of Islam to gain some more dirt on Malcolm and to have somebody on the inside to see what was happening. But Malcolm wasn't a man to hide things. He continued to grow in popularity, and when we get back, we'll talk about what that looks like going into the 60s.
Jimmy, you mentioned that one time after he addressed the crowd, he gave a simple hand gesture and then the crowd dispersed. I think that's probably one of the most iconic pictures that I can remember of Malcolm X. Is that something that's fresh in your mind?
Do you remember that? Holding his fist up in the air.
Yeah. You mentioned Malcolm's popularity grew more. Yeah, over the late 50s and 60s, that is for sure the case. But his speeches and popularity were causing some tension within the Nation of Islam. Malcolm X also discovered that his mentor, his leader, Elijah Muhammad, was having numerous affairs. And this was something that Malcolm just could not get over. He could not forgive him for this. So in March of 1964, Malcolm actually left the Nation of Islam, and he made a Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. While he was doing his pilgrimage, he toured African countries. He actually adopted a Sunni Islam religion. He noticed that there was less racial tension in the Sunni belief system. When he visited Ghana, he met his friend Maya Angelou, who was living there, and she said, quote, "He came to Ghana and said, 'I have found blue-eyed men who am able to call my brother.' So my prior statement that all the whites were devils is erroneous. It takes an incredible amount of courage to be able to say, everybody, you remember what I said yesterday? I have found out that that's wrong." And that's what he was doing. It was amazing. End quote. That was, again, by Maya Angelou. Malcolm wanted to form a new group that would reconnect African Americans more with their heritage. And that was kind of after that Mecca and pilgrimage that he did.
Yeah, of course, this was not received well. I will say that our world would be a much better place if more people would admit they were wrong and that things could change and be better moving forward. But that's not a popular thing to do nowadays, let alone then.
It's one of the oldest sins, pride.
In June of 1964, Malcolm founded the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which advocated for black culture and identity. The organization also held that racism, not the white race, was the greatest threat to black Americans. Again, this is kind of a shift where Malcolm had been saying white people were the problem. Now they're saying that racism is the problem, and it's not inherently the white people that are the actual problem in society. This new movement Malcolm was starting was gaining popularity, and his more moderate stance were influencing the civil rights movement. Again, this is kind of in the middle of all of it in the 60s, right? It was also around this time that Betty started getting death threats over the phone, which is a very unfortunate piece of being prominent in society, is that kind of attention and what that draws to your family. Throughout 1964, Malcolm himself was also repeatedly threatened, which bothered him much less than his wife being threatened. In February, a leader of Temple No. 7 ordered the bombing of Malcolm X's car. Now, again, Temple No. 7, that was one of the temples for the Nation of Islam that Malcolm X used to be a part of. The next month, Elijah Muhammad told a Boston minister that hypocrites like Malcolm should have their heads cut off. So we've gone from Malcolm being a leader in the Nation of Islam, starting a new group, and quickly becoming one of their many targets. The April edition of the Muhammad Speaks newsletter showed a cartoon of Malcolm's bouncing, severed head. On June 8th, FBI surveillance recorded a call where someone told Betty that her husband was as good as dead. 4 days later, the FBI heard a tip that Malcolm X is going to be bumped off, of course, meaning he's going to be killed. So it seems like, I'm sure he got sorts of threats over time, but things were really ramping up here in 1964. That same month, the Nation sued to reclaim Malcolm X's home in Queens because they had been a part of helping him acquire that. They were ordered to leave the night before a hearing on postponing the eviction. The house was destroyed by a fire. So it seems like Malcolm X's world is really collapsing, getting smaller and smaller and more dangerous as time goes on.
This kind of stuff is intriguing. I mean, it's my belief system that if I'm representing Christians, right, then I should expect persecution. But this is intense, man. This is crazy. I don't even know. There's enough of a security detail to make me want to go out and do the speeches like he was doing, even for my religion. On February 19th, 1965, Malcolm actually told an interviewer that the Nation of Islam was actively trying to kill him. And I think that that was not a dramatic statement. I think this was actually happening because just a few days later, February 21st, 1965, Malcolm was going to speak to his organization of Afro-American Unity at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights in New York City. And when he got on stage in front of 400 people, someone in the audience shouted the N-word and then would go on to say, "Get your hand out of my pocket." So as the bodyguards tried to calm the disturbance, there was a large man that rushed towards the stage and shot Malcolm X in the chest with a sawed-off shotgun. Two more men would then rush the stage. These men were carrying handguns, and they continued to shoot Malcolm X. All the while, Malcolm's pregnant wife and four of their daughters were all in attendance, and they were sitting on the front row. So they literally had a front row seat to see their husband and father murdered. He was pronounced dead at 3:30 p.m. at the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. Malcolm X was just 39 years old. His autopsy revealed 21 gunshots to the chest. Also, he was hit in the left shoulder, arms, and legs, including 10 buckshot wounds from the first shotgun blast.
And just to say a little bit more about the mechanics of a shotgun, buckshot being shotgun shoots what is called a wad that comes out, and it scatters with tiny BBs, sort of BBs. And if it's sawed off, then that means it's going to have a wider impact. They're going to spread out further. So it's often done, A, to conceal it, but B, to make sure you can get to your target a little easier. And it's pretty common in, I don't know, anytime you're going to be in close proximity and trying to shoot something.
Yeah, close range combat. They're really useful in like home security. Like if you're going to shoot from your house, it's a, easier to carry and casts a wider shell, like you said.
Also illegal for the most part to alter a weapon in that way, but
they make them that's like they small, look sawed off, but they're just smaller, made on purpose.
So all that to say, there was definitely intent here. Obviously, with multiple shooters, one had this shotgun. The intent was that they were not going to miss. This was not a scare tactic. This was all hands on deck to make sure that they took the life of this young man. I don't know if I would have said 39 was young 10 years ago, but I certainly feel that way now. And it was it was devastating to all of his followers and really the culture of the country at that time. One of the gunmen ended up being beaten by the crowd before police arrived. Turns out that he was a Nation of Islam member known as Talmadge Hayer. And many people in the story have multiple names throughout their lives, so we're going to try to stick with just one for each of them. So if you Google these people, you may see, well, they're also called this or that. So witnesses identified the other two gunmen as also members of the Nation of Islam, Norman 3X Butler and Thomas 15X Johnson. At trial, Hayer confessed, but refused to identify the other assailants. He did, however, emphatically say that they were not Butler or Johnson. So he's trying to take all the blame here, or at least get the blame off of his two co-conspirators. All three, though, were found guilty and sentenced to 20 years to life in 1966. In 1967, Hayer signed an affidavit saying that Butler and Johnson were innocent and that they were not his co-assailants in this shooting. In that affidavit, he names four other Nation of Islam members of Newark's Mosque, number 25, as other participants. That affidavit did not get the case reopened, as we see so often. It's really hard to get a case reopened, and kind of thankful that this didn't. The public viewing of Malcolm X went on for 3 days at Unity Funeral Home in Harlem. There were somewhere between 14 to 30,000 mourners, which is quite the range to say, but tens of thousands of individuals came to pay their respects to Malcolm X. For the funeral, they had loudspeakers set up, and it was broadcast on local television so that people that could not get close enough to see it could still be a part of the observance and the service live while it was happening.
14 to 30,000 people is a lot. I mean, I'm going to have to be cremated because I don't think I have six friends to carry me somewhere in a casket. So that's a lot. The assassination of Malcolm X remains one of the biggest mysteries in true crime. Like, who were the actual shooters? Do they have the right guys? Who was behind this hit? Was it even a hit? You know, these are all questions that I think remain to be answered. Some folks even wonder, you know, how could the FBI and the New York Police Department not have known that this was happening? Did they have extra police presence in the area? Did they know more than what they let on? If they did, why didn't they do anything to stop it? So, yeah, there's even more questions. For instance, on February 23rd of 1965, James Farmer, leader of the Congress of Racial Equality, said at a news conference that local drug dealers were actually to blame, not the Nation of Islam. Is that true? That's, you know, that's a big statement, and what did he have to back that up with? There were other theories that started forming, and that was that the NYPD, the FBI, or the CIA had something to do with it, given they did nothing at all to prevent this from happening. And again, I mean, this takes me back to John F. Kennedy and the other cases that we've spoke about, when there's conspiracy theories going on that our own government, the CIA, had something to do with their murders too. Is there something to that, or is it just where people's minds were going at the time? Many people described the police as moving slowly and completely uninterested in what was going on that day. They even let a dance go on that night at the Audubon Ballroom, kind of signifying that what took place that day was of no real significance to them and they saw no ongoing threat. Years later, during a documentary filming, the lectern where Malcolm X stood was found in the basement, still with bullet holes and with chalk mark circles on it. How does that not get swooped up and taken to somewhere, but just kind of stored in a basement?
Yeah, well, I think it not only shows that they were uninterested, but that they didn't secure the crime scene at all. They let people come in and have a dance that night. This should have been a piece of evidence that could maybe help them match a weapon, could maybe show angles, what have you, but it just ended up in the basement in storage. Fast forward a few years to the 1970s, when the public learned about a series of FBI programs created during the 50s and 60s that were designed to infiltrate and disrupt various civil rights organizations, including the Nation of Islam and the Organization of Afro-American Unity that Malcolm X had started. John Ali was the national security of the Nation of Islam at the time, and it's also known that he was a former FBI agent. Malcolm had told reporters that he and Ali did not get along, and that Ali heightened tensions between Malcolm and his former mentor, leader of the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad. Ali is also an individual that had met with the confessed shooter the night before the assassination. Again, Hayer being the individual that confessed at the time. And I think that's a big, that's a huge red flag. He met with the shooter the night before. In 1985, Butler was let out of prison on parole and became head of the nation's Harlem Mosque in 1998. He continued to maintain his innocence until he died in 2009. Hayer was paroled in 2010. In 2021, Butler and Thomas were exonerated from this murder following a review that found that the FBI and the NYPD withheld key evidence during the trial. So we have for almost, actually more than 50 years, we think we have the answers to this. And then after a review, they withdrew the convictions of Butler, who had passed away, and Thomas as well. This review was 22 months long. It involved defense lawyers and Manhattan prosecutors who had all concluded that the men had been wrongfully convicted. So they were pretty much in consensus about this, at least that there was not enough evidence to convict Butler and Thomas. They found that the FBI and the NYPD failed to examine key information and didn't disclose certain eyewitness accounts that may have helped exonerate both of the men, so it could have been Brady violations. They also did not disclose that there were undercover police officers in the ballroom that day. Again, I can't say this loudly enough. They were surveilling him all the time. There were people there from the NYPD and from the FBI, whether we knew it or not. They were there And I have to think that they at least let part of it happen without intervening. Unfortunately, this review was unable to prove the other four men named by Heyer were involved. So at this point, we just have Heyer as the only individual that's been held accountable for the murder of Malcolm X. All the original eyewitnesses had shaky stories. Today, all of them are dead. The review couldn't come to a conclusion about who ordered the assassination of Malcolm X, which in my opinion is a much bigger question. I think Heyer was involved. You know, as far as the other guys involved, it seemed like there were a lot of witnesses, but who's to tell after all this time? But not being able to tell who ordered it is, I think, it's A, more of a sign of a cover-up, and B, why this remains controversial.
Yeah, how in all of that time could some of those questions not be answered? And I think it's because they didn't, you know, people at the top really didn't want them answered. At the time of his exoneration, Johnson was 83 years old. And all of this really came out because of the Manhattan DA agreeing to review the case before a documentary series on, I guess, on Netflix, right? Called Who Killed Malcolm X? And if you have not watched this, it's really interesting. It's very thorough. Highly recommend it for more information. In it, they dive deep into who really shot Malcolm X, including theories on who fired the first fatal shotgun shot. Heyer's affidavit only gave the first names, and many of these individuals have changed their names when they converted to different religions, so it's really hard to trace things back. Many historians and the documentary filmmakers claim that the other gunmen were from the Newark Mosque, Leon Davis, Benjamin Thomas, and William Bradley. It's widely believed, but never confirmed, that William Bradley is allegedly the one who fired the first shot. Historian Manning Marble theorized that Davis and Thomas were directed by a minister at the Newark Mosque to plan the assassination of Malcolm X for when he returned from his trip overseas. They allegedly recruited the other men who may or may not have been involved. Marble then concludes that allegedly Davis was seated with Heyer in the first row of the ballroom and started shooting Malcolm with handguns after the first shotgun blast. William Bradley denied any involvement in the shooting until the day he died, which was in the year 2018.
Yeah, it's quite the wide web that's cast when you start to trying to identify all of the shooters. Of course, the documentary kind of lands on the leader of that Newark Mosque. I mean, I go back to the fact that the head of security for the Nation of Islam met with Heyer the night before the assassination. And I don't know. I don't know that I'm ready to throw our government under the bus for causing this one, but I think they definitely allowed it without intervening. Maybe they even got a tip and just said, all right, we'll let it go.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to compile a list of all the things that our government may or may not have let happen. Just add this one to that growing list.
I saw a great TikTok the other day, not to make light of what we're talking about here, but a guy said that he's had some people say that you shouldn't believe any conspiracies. And he's like, you're telling me you think the government's batting 1,000. They're in charge of 330 million people. I'm a father of one kid and I lie to him all the time. Like you do sometimes because you think it's right to protect people. You do it because you don't want to look like a hypocrite. Like, our government lies about things. I think that's pretty clear. But what things are they lying about? I think that's part of maybe why they lie so much. It makes it hard to identify what's the truth and what's not.
I'm going to try really hard not to engage too much because I feel like an epic John rant coming on if I start talking about the government too much.
I get that.
So I'm just gonna stop.
Yeah, certainly a tragedy. I think there's a lot more to learn here. There are certainly some films about Malcolm X. He has a fairly prominent role in the Muhammad Ali film with Will Smith as Ali. So you can learn about it out there, but I think because there were people convicted and a confession of the person convicted, that it's less of a conspiracy, so people don't bring it up as much. And he was so much younger than all these other guys we've been talking about. So he wasn't as old as Martin Luther King Jr., JFK, when they were assassinated. So it's certainly a piece of history that I think gets overlooked way too much. And as you start to dive in here, we weren't able to cover. Mackenzie took the lead on the research here, and she told us, she was like, I didn't chase all the rabbit holes. This could have been a whole series of episodes. So we wanted to get to the basics, and all that to basically say he was a civil rights leader that a lot of people, other organizations and some law enforcement agencies identified as a problem, and he was killed in a place where he should have been protected. And the investigation was not done thoroughly. I think all those things we can say confidently.
Yep, I absolutely agree. Jamie, thank you, man. This one is interesting, and I learned a lot about Malcolm X in my research for this case. So thank you, and thank you guys for listening. You guys are what we do, or who we do this for, and we are just so thankful for you.
Yep. Thanks for keeping the lights on. The best way to help us out is by a 5-star review. Also a great way to recommend a case. We had a recommendation come in a few months ago for Tanya Knight, and we have our team on research for that one and plan to cover that one soon. So great way to recommend a case.
Also, don't forget, for as little as $3 a month, you can have access to all of our episodes, our bonus episodes, and our regular series early and ad-free by just joining Patreon. Patreon.com. While you're there, search up True Crime Cast. Easy to do, easy to sign up. You get all your podcasts in one place that way. It's awesome.
You guys are the best. Thanks so much.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.